Spread the fire. Welcome back to SMWX. And today I'm extremely excited again for the third time by popular demand to be joined by Ugogo Aubrey Machigli. Thokozani gogo.
Thokozani ke.
And before we kick off, can we speak about why it's appropriate to address you as gogo? Some people in our audience have wondered why I refer to you as gogo. So let's start with just understanding why I refer to you as Ugogo Aubrey Machigli.
Well, I walk with many spirits. Some of the spirits are from my bloodline, some are not. Some are feminine or female or masculine or male. The spirit that has possessed me is a female spirit, my great-grandmother. And because it is a great-grandmother, a female spirit, that is my guiding spirit. That's why I'm called Gogo. But very close to her, I have come to discover there is Umkhulu, grandfather. Mm. So there are people who, recognizing that the main spirit that guides me is a female spirit, will call me Gogo. Mm. There are those who will see Ugogo, but also see Umkhulu. Mm. And will call me Gogo Mkhulu.
Oh, okay.
So whether you are a male or female sangoma, if you are possessed by a female spirit, your guiding spirit is female, you are called Gogo. So that's why you'll have Gogos who are women and Gogos who are men. But women can also be Mkhulu. If that woman, the guiding spirit, is a male spirit. Mm. Mm. So she will be called Umkhulu. And there's an interesting dynamic here. So if I, as Ugogo, get married to a woman who is Umkhulu,
wow,
a female sangoma who is Umkhulu,
yeah,
there's a very interesting dynamic. So these two sangomas, this man and the woman, marry in a patriarchal society.
Mm.
So I, as a man, may expect this woman, a sangoma who is Mkhulu, to, as a woman, comply with the demands of patriarchy and treat me as a man, as patriarchy demands. On the other hand, patriarchy can extend to our spiritual relationship in the sense that I am Ugogo. I may be the one who is expected to submit to Mkhulu, this female sangoma. So there is that interesting dynamic. But the two of us will have to negotiate this very carefully. Because if we don't, these two dynamics become a source of conflict, a source of conflict that may even lead to the breakup of marriage. Now, of course, one of the things that guides how I think we should manage this is how is our conception of God. And in what I am taught by my own ancestors is that those, especially some of the feminists, who argue that God is a woman, are not being radical to say so. Because to say so is to humanize God. So because God is not human, God can neither be a man nor a woman. So God is not a man. God is not a woman. To call God a man or a woman is to humanize God. Yeah. So the spiritual realm, at one level, is a realm that we should understand as being non-gendered. But to the extent that the spiritual realm presents itself to us, at times in ways that are familiar to the human mind and its limitations, it may present itself in a gendered fashion. But we know that the spiritual realm is a non-gendered realm. So when I see, for instance, my late father in a dream, I must distinguish between my father's spirit and the body of my father buried at a cemetery in the vow. And remember that what I see in that dream, this man, is a spirit, but it must present itself to me in a way that is familiar to the mind. Otherwise, in reality, the mind is incapable of imagining what the spirit looks like. Therefore, my mind is incapable of imagining what my father's spirit looks like.
Well, I feel both enlightened and even more comfortable in addressing you as Ugogo or Brumashikri. And thanks a lot, because a number of people in our audience were interested about that. And thanks for clarifying that for us. Well, let's descend to the terrestrial realm, because we are in quite an interesting phase. The last time we spoke, 2019, there was still a great deal of hope about changing the trajectory of South Africa. And we approached the State of the Nation address, SONA 2020, in February. What are your thoughts in terms of the state of our nation at the moment going into the SONA address?
Well, to the extent that the hope came with the election of Cyril Ramaphosa as president of the ANC in December 2017 and head of state in February 2018 and after the 2019 elections, I have never had hope. Because from day one, I have argued and I still argue and I will continue to argue unless evidence to the opposite accuses itself that this is the weakest leader the ANC has ever produced. And this is for both objective and subjective reasons. So I'm talking about his subjective weaknesses as a leader, but I'm also talking about the objective conditions in which he must lead. Both of which render him quite a weak leader.
Let's go into those. So what are some of the subjective and objective conditions that you identify?
Well, subjectively, having followed his career for many years, having grown up in the UDF and the ANC, CCP, and so on, I have never been convinced that he is presidential material. In the same way that Jacob Zuma was not presidential material. But I've always thought that he would have made the perfect president as a successor to Nelson Mandela when we were going through this delusional period of rainbowism and a distorted idea of what constitutes a non-racial society, confusion about South Africa belonging to all who live in it, when that is an aspiration, that is something we still need to achieve, the reality that South Africa belongs to those who conquered it. But I think in the middle of that delusional post-1994 moment about a rainbow nation, in that honeymoon moment, he would have made a perfect leader to succeed Mandela. But what it would have meant is that, like Mandela to some extent, and the words we put in his mouth about reconciliation, his conception of reconciliation, and that comes to the fore from time to time, even now, would have been a conception of reconciliation that is not rooted in the understanding that reconciliation will result from the amelioration of the lot of our people, the alteration of fundamental alteration of the social, economic, class, gender, and other conditions of our people, particularly those who are oppressed during apartheid. Now, that's not the kind of reconciliation he would have posited. But that would have worked for him, because in the immediate period after the 94 elections, that worked.
That's so true, because it almost feels like we're having a 94 presidency within a 2020 moment.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, here we have a Cyril Ramaphosa who emerges as president of the ANC and the country at a time when the ANC is in decline, first of all, but also at a time when South Africa is in need of a new revolution. Because revolutions must renew themselves or must be replaced by other revolutions. And South Africa is at that moment now. South Africa must decide whether this revolution must be renewed or it must be replaced by another revolution. In that context, he is not the man for this moment. And objectively, as I said, he emerges at a time when the ANC is in a state of decline at a moral level. In terms of the quality of leadership and leaders, it makes available to itself, first of all, and to the country. It is in a state of decline intellectually. It is in a state of decline in strategic terms and in tactical terms. And the decline is deepening. So that's the objective condition he faces. So if we want to be kind, we will ignore the fact that he is produced by that decline. So he is a product of that decline himself. But like his predecessor, Jacob Zuma, he is an instrument of its deepening. So he plays that secular role, that of being a product of the decline and also being the leader who deepens the crisis beyond what it was during Jacob Zuma's tenure. So, which means South Africa and the ANC are in need of a leader who is aligned to this moment. But we as a nation need to think even beyond this when you think about the ANC. Because you have the revolution, you have the ANC. The ANC is an instrument of the revolution. And the question South Africans must ask is whether the ANC today remains an instrument of the revolution. If it is not, can it be changed? If it cannot be changed, must it be discarded? Those are the questions which face us. We are also going through a period that is best characterized by Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. Because we are going through a very deep political, social, and economic crisis, coinciding with the decline in the quality of our political class, and therefore the quality of our politics, particularly formal politics. South Africa is facing a situation where policy decisions will be imposed from outside. And therefore it's become susceptible to the imposition of policy positions by ratings agencies, international investors, global capital, and so on. Secondly, we have become susceptible to populism. But what it means also is that, if I'm correct in saying the crisis is a political crisis that is deeper than the crisis in the ANC and the DA, then I must be correct in saying that our political class and therefore our politics is in a state of decline. And if that is correct, we must look at the leading political forces in our country differently. Let me give an example of the ANC and the DA. So Musi Maimane and Herman Mashaba resigned from the DA. Why do they resign? At a very basic level, Musi Maimane makes the mistake of forgetting, if he has ever known, what the raison d'etre of the DA is, that this is a party that has established to promote the interests of the English-speaking middle class. Put in another way, the interests of whiteness. So when you challenge Cyril Ramaphosa in the manner that he did by exposing what may have been a corrupt relationship between him and Bosasa, you undermine not Ramaphosa, you undermine this project of the DA, the project of promoting whiteness, the interests of this English-speaking middle class, which with the formation of the DA after the DP formed an alliance with the conservative Afrikaner elements. So that's why my money had to go, because he did not understand why the DA exists. But he also did not understand why the emergence of Ramaphosa was important for these interests. It is important because either by design or by default, the DA stumbles on the realization that it does not have to be a ruling party. In other words, it does not have to win the hearts and minds of the black majority and govern. It does not have to do that. When what it seeks to achieve by becoming a ruling party can be achieved through an ANC that is loyal by design or by default to the interests of white capital, the interests of whiteness in general, and the interests of global capital.
So what you're saying is that the ANC can appeal to a mass base much more effectively than the DA while still
exactly
in many ways serving an agenda which is coincident with the DA's agenda.
And that is why I continue to argue that when a black person votes for the ANC, that black person is voting for his or her disenfranchisement. Because he is voting for, or she is voting for a party that at the moment, as I say, by design or by default, exists, hopefully inadvertently, but politics doesn't work that way, to promote the interests, not of the classes it represents, its core constituency, but the interests of a core constituency that is part of the support base of another party, the DA.
And where do you see the EFF fitting into this? Because, of course, there was at least some hope that the EFF might represent something new, some kind of alternative. At the same time, it seems in many ways to fall within similar patterns to ANC politics in its culture, in its structure. It's just come out of this National People's Assembly now. What's your view on how it fits into this declining political class that you've defined?
Well, let's ask the question this way. If democracy was your spouse, would you stay in the marriage? If liberal democracy, which is our model of democracy, if it was your spouse, would you stay in that marriage?
Is the spouse Gogo or Mkulu?
Either way. Either way, given our constitutional framework. Would you stay in that marriage? If the ANC was your spouse, would you stay in that marriage? If the DA was your spouse, would you stay in that marriage? What you're asking me is, if the EFF was my spouse, would I stay in that marriage? Now, when it comes to liberal democracy, I definitely would have filed for divorce long ago. But it brings me to a deeper question. So we engage in a liberation struggle to create a society that is antithetical to what we had during apartheid. But actually, we are on a journey towards the achievement of a higher goal, a society that, in qualitative terms, will be antithetical to even this society that is antithetical to apartheid society. That's what we seek to achieve. Is this achievable through politics as it is practiced today? Or is it achievable to through politics. So the question I'm asking, to the extent that I personally believe that politics as it is practiced in the world and how we've modeled ourselves on how politics is practiced in the West, to the extent that it, I don't believe, will ever deliver on this goal I have outlined. We therefore, with each election, engage in a mere ritual. A ritual that is disconnected from this goal. A ritual that is disconnected from the aspirations and desires of our people. So, if I'm correct, politics is not going to deliver what the ANC calls a better life. And therefore, no configuration of parties in your coalition or alliance or otherwise, as part of this politics, can deliver on what the ANC calls a better life. And therefore, no single party, whether you're talking the ANC or the DA or the EFF, can deliver. Because the model is wrong. The model is not a model that is designed to deliver. Or evidence, if we're not being denialist, on balance, evidence shows that the liberal democratic model and how we practice politics within this model, evidence shows that it cannot deliver on this promise of a better life.
So perhaps the project for us as citizens is not simply to try and think of some new party or to try and better the parties that already exist, but to look at our system as it is now and try to think about
how let me put it this way. Is this the best way in economic, social, and political terms of organizing society? And I'm saying, no, it's not. It's not the best way, you know. And in the same way that I say that South Africa needs a new revolution, or the current revolution needs to be renewed, I also argue that we need to reach for a different way of organizing society, the liberal democratic way, and the neoliberal way in which economies are organized, particularly in the West and here, is not going to change the lot of our people. So we're going to engage in these rituals, economic rituals, political rituals, with the same outcomes. But I do believe that we are reaching a point in South Africa where we are going to see the beginnings of a decoupling between the people and their interests on the one hand, and their belief in the efficacy of the model we have chosen. And when that happens, that's when we see deeper levels of conflict than we see, or instability than we see at the moment. In case I'm accused of having ducked the question about the EFF, I struggle to see the EFF as a solution. I struggle at two levels. The first level may not be intellectually sustainable, because I struggle at the level of suspicion. My suspicion is that the EFF is not being truthful to us. In other words, the EFF, like the DA, misrepresents itself to our people. And to the extent that I believe that words are not what they describe, the revolutionary words of the EFF, I do not believe are what they describe. And if I am wrong because the EFF has not had an opportunity to govern and prove me wrong. But if I am right, I'm right for two reasons. That objectively, it is part of a liberal democratic model that cannot deliver on the revolutionary vision it espouses. And if it cannot realize that, it is not worthy of the title of ruling party. Because a party that is founded on the revolutionary vision it posits should find it obvious that the liberal democratic model within which it operates should be uprooted. They will argue that, well, to the extent that we espouse socialism, we are doing exactly that. We are positing an alternative to the current political, social, and economic model. And I will say that a lot of what parades as ideology at the moment, where they are talking about socialism or communism or capitalism, particularly socialism and capitalism, is nothing but nostalgia for an order that may have existed or for an order that was imagined to exist and did not exist. And in my view, the human mind must reach beyond the ideological strictures of communism or socialism or capitalism. And that brings us to another question. I've said I don't believe they're being truthful. We also need to engage with this idea of truth. So you have people who talk about the fact that the world, South Africa, is going through a period of post-truth. We're in a post-truth period.
Yeah.
I think our people and people all over the world still hunger for the truth, and they still can recognize the lie. So I don't think this is a post-truth period. I think it's a post-complexity period. We have become averse to complexity, and therefore we've become averse to managing complexity, and to some way, falling back on old ideas, old ideological ideas of socialism, capitalism, communism, and all, and remanufacturing the conflict between them is evidence of this aversion to complexity and managing complexity.
So over the last 25 years, the ANC has certainly played a fundamental role in the political landscape, the formal political landscape, but it's also been a major part of society, memory, and history. Yeah. And
identity.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But it just seems to me, as the ANC goes into its NGC now, which I think will be a far more important moment than a lot of people are giving it credit for. The fragility of the ANC, despite its exterior unity, President Ramaphosa came out of this recently, Khotla, saying, you know, people were expecting a big fight and they just got unity. It seems like it's in an extremely fragile state for me, and our society in the next period is going to have to deal with an ANC that either splits or is significantly weakened or simply is incapable of finding the force that it had in those important early years in our democracy.
Well, I think what has happened, there's what I call the ANC, the construct, the myth. And to the extent that some of us are unhappy today, we're unhappy because of the gap between the construct and reality. So the ANC becomes dominant in our lives during and after the liberation struggle because it benefits from its mythical dimensions, the extent to which we have constructed a particular ANC. And we do the same with its leaders. We create these paragons of virtue. We construct these leaders of angelic proportions.
You know, as you say that, it seems to me that that is going to be increasingly difficult, because I see the ANC as having three potential outcomes. One is that, let's call it the Ramaphosa faction. Of course, it's more complex than that, but that grouping gains the ascendancy, and it becomes clear that they're in the ascendancy in June this year. The other scenario is the second, which is that the grouping which seeks to dislodge Ramaphosa gains the ascendancy, yeah. and that becomes clear. Or paralysis,
yeah.
dressed as unity.
Yeah.
And neither of those situations can deliver anything particularly fruitful,
yeah.
which then means into a situation where our politics is exactly the same, but there are different labels. So
you are right.
We don't have a DA, ANC, EFF. Yeah. We have maybe five or six
yeah.
categories of the exact same power structure dressed in a different garb.
You have crystallized what I've been trying to say over the past 30 minutes.
Mm.
That it doesn't matter whether it's what we call the Ramaphosa faction. Mm. And as you said, it's much more complex like that or
yeah.
the anti-Ramaphosa or Zuma faction or whatever.
Mm.
Because this concept, these factions are forming, reforming, there's consolidation, deconsolidation yeah. going on all the time, depending Absolutely. On what interests are on the table.
Mm,
mm, mm. So it doesn't matter whether what gains ascendance is the Ramaphosa faction or his opponents or the DA or the EFF, in my view. You still emerge with the same crisis. But let's limit ourselves to the ANC.
Yeah.
If the Ramaphosa faction wins the battle, the weakness of that outcome lies in the fact that it is a faction that represents interests that run counter to the vision of South Africa that is antithetical to apartheid South Africa. Because I do believe that with both factions, or all factions in the ANC, what we see represented is a widening gap between the cause and what they represent.
Well, Gogo, hopefully we'll be able to touch base with you regularly again this year. Thank you so much once again for blessing us with your incisive analysis.
Thokoza.
Thanks for watching the content. Like, share, and subscribe on all platforms. smwx.co.za to join the WhatsApp channel. And let's build a new conversation for a new generation. Are you?